This Do Lectures episode features Neil's Yard Remedies and Trill Farm founder Romy Fraser, a real pioneer in the beauty industry, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2018.
I'm just going to tell you a bit about my journey and maybe the things I've learned along the way and maybe how they connect together and how you can string a few versions of yourself into a lifetime. So I thought I'd talk about my life as I'm growing up and why I set up Neil's Yard Remedies. So I was born to an artistic, church-going English mother, and my dad, Scottish-Canadian, homesteading guy who he ran away from his small farm in Alberta when he was 13. He hated it so much. He went up to the Northern Territories, and I've got a few souvenirs that he collected, but I know nothing really about it. And I don't know very much about him driving cattle south into California, and that was during the 30s, 1930s. So I didn't really know much about him. During his funeral, some guy got up and talked about how he was one of the guys that let people out of concentration camps. He was always in the background. I never really knew him. But one thing I do know is that when I was 8, he absolutely refused to let me have a pony. And you might know that when you're 8, you live in the country, all you sort of want, if you're a girl anyway, is a pony. So I managed to persuade my parents that if by the age of 13 I still wanted a pony and I'd saved up the money, then I should be allowed to have one. And they agreed. They clearly didn't know that I would do that. Through my teens, I had the freedom with my pony to discover nature. We'd travel miles from home through beech woods. And it was that sort of freedom that I learned, and actually I go back to remembering. It wasn't a perfect childhood by any means, but I quite enjoyed school, and one of the teachers I had was convinced me that education was in fact the way to change the world away from injustice and inequality. And so around that time I decided that I wanted to be a teacher. We talk of consumerism and economic growth and environmental destruction. Yet poverty, marginalisation are still growing. We've been talking about it for ages. And I read recently that as many as 40% of the plants and animals that we're familiar with will be extinct by the end of the century. Which isn't great. I mean, we all know this. But it's not great for our grandchildren. So, when I grew up, I learned that because somehow, even though I had a pony, even though we lived in the countryside, we never really had any money to spend. So I grew up knowing that all the food we grew, we had to preserve. We'd have to remake somebody else's clothes for us to wear. What we had too much of, we'd give away. So when I left school and then trained to teach, by the way, when I was at college, I decided I would never teach. I just knew that working to support the government and the way they wanted to train kids to become part of what they were perpetuating, I realised wasn't for me. So my first real job was in a small democratic school. It's a sort of experiment, a bit like Summerhill. It's called Kirkdale. And here, the kids were allowed to choose how to spend their day, but the teacher's skill was to give them, to make their day as intellectually challenging as they could, as well as giving them the freedom to spend time and choose if they wanted to be outside. So, by the way, that's me standing up in the back. So how do we get our kids to grow, or us actually, beyond the age of wanting to own and control nature? Not only nature, things that we see. The school was run in South London in a large, rambling Victorian house with sloping gardens. And there were sand pits, aerial runways, big lawn where you could take your favourite book to go and sit down and read. And I think because the kids could choose, I'm sort of interested in that active decision-making process. Because the kids could choose, they would learn what those choices ended up by becoming, how they could learn. Every Easter and summer holidays, we'd take the kids camping, firelighting, swimming, night games. But after 6 years, I realised it was an education not just for those few kids, but actually it should be an education for the kids that weren't privileged. It should be an education for everybody. So I decided that I wanted to set up a school with better funding. Now, it was around that time that I was teaching that I started to study homeopathy. And for me, it was a great tool because I was able to look after my two daughters and learn how to be healthy. It was a tool for my health. So that was my other interest. Education and the whole political side of education was one thing. Natural medicine was another. And I had a friend who said that He used to come in and help do sort of mad science projects at the school. And then he phoned me up one day and said he'd bought some property in the centre of London and needed somebody to rent the shop space. Would I be interested? Because he knew that I was interested in natural medicines. My first thought was, how on earth can I do that? Because actually, I was using washing up liquid to wash my hair. I knew nothing about toiletries and actually wasn't terribly interested. But I was really keen on natural remedies. And it amazed me, it was so difficult to get the natural remedies. You couldn't, they weren't easily accessible. And also, people had lost that traditional art of knowing how to use them. So when Nick said, what about it? And I'll guarantee you a loan. I thought, yeah, I can do the whole natural medicine thing and really provide the public with the remedies and the know-how, but also everybody in business makes loads of money. I'll make the money and set up my school. So that was that sort of, I remember it really well. Nick said, oh, I think you better think about it. When I said, yeah, I'll do it. No, think about it. And I said, no, I don't need to think about it. I absolutely know. And in hindsight, I suppose that sort of moment, which I'm sure many of you will recognize, and actually, is being talked about, but that sort of moment is magic. That's when magic happens. It's like bringing together your past and that moment of courage, and you just make magic. So, here we go. There am I, somebody I was working with. We open with 120 jars of dried herbs. I'm packing everything in the back of the shop. I'm making some of the stuff, not everything. Um, 200 homeopathic remedies in the cupboard, and so on. And just a diversion, I remember when we were going, I've been through several sort of redesign processes of the blue bottles. And I remember somebody saying to me, well, have a look at Milk Tray. You can see how the design process, you can still recognize it. It's still Neil's Yard, but it just brings it more up to date. I was never sure of that, but I'm really glad they didn't stay looking like this. I started off the blue bottles. For me, it was obvious. I could buy them sort of off the shelf from France. And I just liked the shape. There had to be coloured glass to protect the herbs that I put inside. So the bottles were obvious. But I started off with a label, same sort of shape, but the lozenge in the middle, I'd write what the product was. Well, I didn't last long. Lasted about 6 months, I think, because my handwriting was so rubbish. But what was great was that I started to see the natural remedies that I was really interested in. I started to see how they could be a possibility for the toiletries. So when I started putting them into other stores, I just felt that they would be effective. It was a sort of secret of mine that I just wanted them to go into design stores, really because I felt they would be looked after properly. But I knew that people would come back because I completely believed that the product was good. So I had no idea where the company was going. I was not really a planner. I was a doer, and I just learnt along the way. Definitely no plans. And coming out of school teaching, I was quite good at organisation. So that seemed to be the basic skill, the fundamental thing you have to do if you're running a business. The staff, the team that we built up, that was good fun because I was able to get them to go on courses and encourage them in natural medicines, but also I was able to say, actually, let's make this business work because we're all going to be part of doing something with education. So there was always quite a strong education theme throughout the life of Niels Yard Remedies. And I'll just run through very quickly some of the projects that we worked on. So we ran 3 PhD research programs, which was really good fun, exploring plant properties and how best to use them. We published quite a few books and papers. We worked with a local primary school in South London. They were our next door school, on some lovely projects about plants. And this is, these kids had never been to the countryside before. I mean, it doesn't improve, does it? But anyway. And for many years, I ran a bursary scheme to support anybody that wanted to seriously study natural medicine. We created a series of workshops to take into different states and for teenagers and community groups. And then I rented some land in Dorset, and it also had a flat. And so anybody from the company could come and work in the herb garden that's echinacea at the back. They could do some herb growing, but they could also have a country weekend too. So by this time, I'd grown the company to about 24, 25 stores in the UK. And I was able to do this because when there was somebody who was great working in the shop, I'd say, do you want to do a store? Because I think it would be good if we had one in Edinburgh or Liverpool or wherever. I thought we should have one. And if they were up for studying natural medicine and they were prepared to commit themselves for a year, then we'd take them on. So by 2003, I knew we had to move out of London because actually we couldn't stay in our existing premises in Battersea, and I wanted to start growing the herbs that we could put into the ingredients and doing distillation and all of that. So I bought this bit of land in North Dorset and built this reasonably eco factory. It was quite a hard slog. And I don't know if any of you have done anything like that, but it costs 30% more than an ordinary factory. It sort of, I didn't quite see why. But it was really fun designing the factory around the people. So that middle bit is where people could come together and talk and discuss and watch films, eat. We had a great restaurant. But I did have to disrupt. We had an 80-strong team in Battersea doing the manufacturing, and I was asking them to relocate to Dorset. About 40% of them agreed to do that. But as an inner city company, we now had to change and grow in a different environment. The purpose of the company had sort of changed. It was, instead of growing a healthier, more fun, more exciting company, I suddenly found myself having to sell more products, more landfill, more sort of marketing to get people to spend what actually they didn't need to buy. So I felt that it wasn't really possible. This is just me, and there are other ways of looking at it. But at the time, I felt that it wasn't really possible for it to carry on being a model business that was truly ecological, that truly talked about what it stood for. And I sort of realized that once you become aware of something, you can't really pretend that it's otherwise. So I decided to sell the company in 2005. That could be another whole talk. But I wanted to sell it when I felt really good about the products, the people, and the purpose of the company. And I sold it because the company needed new focus, but I too remembered that it was about time I set up my school. So here we are. 2 years later, in 2007, this is Trill Farm. It's on the Dorset-Devon border. And I feel, I'm still there, I feel it is the home to the educational project that I'd originally dreamt of. It's really important to me that it's a working farm. I want to produce food. It's important that we know about food. It's important that we teach people the best way of growing food. At the same time, it evolved into me hosting a group of small enterprises. So with 300 acres, and it's very diverse land. It's mainly permanent pasture, but we do have 50 acres of woodlands. So I realized quite quickly it was very hard. I mean, it's hard enough being a farmer, but it's very hard being a model farm where you champion biodiversity. And you can make it work as a viable enterprise in each of those different bits. So what would I do with the water meadows or the woodlands or whatever? So it evolved that I brought together a number of small businesses. These businesses have four main values that we share: cooperation between us, shared responsibility, recycling, maintenance of the machinery, ecological sensitive use of the land. So the business has, each of these businesses have to use the land at Trill Farm, but it has to be done in a particular way. The year after, or 2 years after I'd arrived there, I got organic status. But also, and most importantly, the commitment to pass on what those businesses have learned. So it's turning out that it's not so much a school that I'm creating, but a new sort of farm. We focus on showing how we can make a living. This is Ash and Kate, who run a really successful vegetable growing business. And in fact, they in turn are being real innovators in seed saving and all sorts of other initiatives. But we want to preserve the natural diversity as well. So we invite the public, any of you, to join our natural world. This is Jake, who bought my herd of Red Devon cattle and also brought in Cheviot sheep. He's great. So we produce our own food, our textiles. We've built sustainable buildings and energy systems. We're a small group of citizens working towards building a sustainable and equitable society. We rely a lot on groups of volunteers who are great. Karen runs a falconry, which is great. We host community groups, schools, and run various events. Now I'm just going to flick through some of the other things we do. Our woodland platform, doing yoga, beekeeping, that's having fun on the aerial walkway, food processing, using everything that we grow, working in the carpentry, having a bit more fun bouldering, and just sitting outside the cafe and just chatting. So soon we are still on track, well, maybe a bit behind, but we're still thinking we're going to launch a leadership program. So leadership and learning about responsibility and yourself. This program is for young adults. They're going to learn through learning practical skills, but also from each other. We don't have any school building or set curriculum, but we are working on it. And the young adults will be using nature as their classroom. And they've got a team of committed and very skillful people to work with. So as I mentioned earlier, it's the challenge has been to make the farm a viable project. And for me, that's quite a dilemma, because I believe that working life should be flexible and not be a separate part of our lives. Work should be integrated into who we are, what we want to do. Because health, I believe, is an expression of being in balance. And of course, that must include the work we do. We used to go swimming in the top pond at lunchtimes. And sort of we got out of the habit of doing that. I think there's too much focus on work being the measurement for our success. And it's to the detriment of our well-being. And all of us here, I assume, believe that our health does reflect the balance of our life. But this too has to be reflected in the environment. So what we do with our life actually has this impact in the environment. And it works both ways round. And the environment can't really change until we understand the absolute importance of the way we live. So it seems to me, whichever way you look at it, we're having to increasingly work together in an increasingly conscious way. Ourselves, the environment, and actually that we can't leave the global impact out either. So how do we make all this add up and start to work? In business, profit sharing, equal staff representation on the company board would be a start. Diversity of the management reflecting the workers should be a matter of course. We should insist that political change, equality of ownership, shared land rights are the solutions. But they do seem pretty far away. I put this slide in because last year we hosted a load of child refugees. We thought they were all going to be Syrian, but actually they came from everywhere. And this is them singing around the fire. They were a joy to have. And it was a real privilege to host them. We're going to do the same this summer. But those aims for the child soldier, the refugee, or the kid that can't cope in the inner city school. Those aims are too far away. So we're creative people, we're employers, we're organisation leaders here. And I don't really think that we can do anything other than, this is what I believe. You guys might have other ideas. I think we have to pick up the rubbish in front of us, be committed to recycling. I think we have to be kind to our neighbour. We have to buy wisely, just choose. Really make that choice. And I guess, above everything else, we have to understand ourselves or certainly set off in that direction. Because I'm convinced that in our own personal actions lie the secret to global change. The trick is to act with hope and with courage and believe in your own magic. Thank you very much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.